Today, putting people first with Senator Jared Rennick. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news. Today I'm joined by Senator Rennick. Hi, Senator. Great to have you back.
Yeah, hi, Martin. It's great to be back. Long time no see.
Yeah, indeed. Now, you've made a very important announcement this past week, and I want to go through that with you because I think this is a really important signal about how broken politics is in Australia.
Politics, I mean, you know, politics and being broken, you know, the toxicity of politics, it's, you know, it's par for the course. You know, the words go together. Look, I took a stand throughout the COVID period, not just against vaccines, by the way, but the mandates and the lockdowns and the lockouts. And, you know, a lot of people in the party held that against me because, you know, I literally put the people first and not the party. And, you know, I mean, look, I get when you're in a party, you're not always going to agree with everything the party does, but you don't necessarily take a stand. But I felt when people were being injured and having their livelihoods destroyed and not being able to be with their loved ones, et cetera, for the relative risk of getting a virus, albeit, you know, people have varying views on this, but I just felt like as though it probably went on a bit too long and the government overreacted a bit too hard. You know, politics is, that's politics. I mean, I've got further issues with the pre-selection. There were irregularities there. In the end, we didn't go to court about the substance of the matter at all. I tried to keep it low-key, so I said nothing for the entire time. These, you know, irregularities were being questioned by myself and other members of the federal team, including Peter Dutton, I might add, who gave me his full support throughout the whole time. So I want to be very clear about that. But then when we finally went to court, the court ruled that court party matters were not justiciable. So the long and short of that, and this is something I will discuss further on down the track when I'm not, you know, I want to focus on the issues at the moment, is that the courts have ruled that the people who make the laws are above the laws. And I've got a real issue with that as well, to a degree. So obviously inside a party, you know, you've got party membership. I don't think that has to be justiciable. I think the party has the right to decide who can join and who can't. I think they have a right to decide who can be a candidate and who can't. But once you decide to hold a pre-selection, you've got to conduct that pre-selection within the rules of democratic rules. And that wasn't conducted. I won't bother talking about the irregularities. And that's what I find very disappointing with the courts, is that they wash their hands of a pre-selection process that is a part of the democratic process. Because if you look at the makeup of the lower house, for example, generally speaking, you've got 60 safe red, 60 safe blue, and then say 30 marginal seats in the middle that, you know, swing with the tide. And a lot of your ministers come from the safe seats, because to become a minister most of the time, unless you're exceptional, you've got to be in the party for a long time, you know, in the parliamentary wing to climb up into the ministry. So it's very important that those pre-selections are conducted fairly and democratically. And I think that's something that we need to have a good look at, and I will be raising those issues further on down the track, but obviously not today, because I want to actually talk about issues that are going to help the people and so that Australians can have better lives.
Right, so you've essentially announced that you're going independent, you're going to create a new party, we're going to put people first. And very interestingly, you've started now to talk about what some of those policies might look like. And, you know, my feedback from people that I speak with and through my shows is that many people are quite frustrated with the disconnect between what politicians seem to think is important and what ordinary people feel is really important. So can we go through some of those policy areas and just sort of highlight where you think the focus should be?
Well, the focus should be on the people. And we should be, the government should be focused on serving the people and empowering the people. And I think the best way you can help people is help them help themselves. And that's why, rather than what we've seen over the last 30 or 40 years, and I'm sure I've probably said this on your show before, is that we've seen governments walk away from the provision of essential services and march on into the family home, the bedroom, the classroom, the corporate boardroom, and then, you know, throughout COVID, the doctor's waiting room, telling people what they can and can't do in their own personal lives. And that's, you know, something that I just totally find abhorrent. I'm just against every fibre of my body. I think we've got to encourage people to stand up and empower them to make their own choices. I mean, the word freedom's thrown around a lot, and it's, you know, it's very overused. I'd prefer to use the words, you know, empower people to make decisions and be able to stand on their own two feet, because you're never really free. You know, we're not free from hunger, thirst, you know, the need to be loved, etc. But what we can do is empower people to make sure that they're capable of achieving those things with as little government assistance, or becoming dependent on the government on the way through. So do you want me to go straight into the five policies?
Well, I was going to say, you've actually now articulated five. Why don't we just go through them one by one? Because I think, you know, together they build a really coherent picture of what you're actually talking about.
Yeah, thanks. So the first one is that I want to lift the tax-free threshold to $40,000. I've worked in tax. My prior experience has been in tax and finance, but I've always had an issue with the fact that companies can get a tax deduction for the cost of doing business, but people can't get, you know, people who just go to work on a wage or a salary can't get a tax deduction for the cost of living. And effectively, I think it's silly to tax people below the cost, you know, who earn less than the cost of living or around the cost of living. Similar amounts of the cost of living. If we tax them and it takes them back below the poverty line, we're not really helping them and enabling them to stay, keep their heads above the water. So, and the other thing in terms of costing it, so we've got 14 million people you'd be giving a $3,500 tax cut to. That works out prima facie at about $49 billion. The other thing, though, is Treasury don't model secondary impacts. So they ignore the velocity of money by income band. And I have a real issue with that, because you give $1,000 to someone on low income, it's highly likely most of that $1,000 will be back in Treasury coffers via increased GST, higher corporate taxes, higher PAYGs from increased economic activity within the next 12 months. So as opposed to, say, someone who's on a higher income, an extra $1,000 to them may just mean they pay an extra $1,000 for an imported car, or spend longer, you know, another weekend overseas. So I would like to see, I'm going to assume that it's about a 50% velocity, so about half the tax cut would come back in, and then I'm going to provide those savings via effectively getting rid of subsidies for renewables. And I'm happy to get rid of subsidies for any other energy, by the way. And also getting rid of the Environment Department in Canberra. And I'm happy to look at getting rid of other bureaucratic departments that are in Canberra that are run by the states, because we've got too much duplication of bureaucracy in this country, and it's killing us. And the other thing is, I want to means test that defined benefit scheme, which is currently undiscounted over $300 billion for the non-military white-collar federal bureaucrats. And there was a good example last week, just David Anderson, who is intending on leaving the ABC. His scheme, apparently, according to media reports, is that he will get 37% of his retiring salary, which I think is about $1.2 million. So it works out at, you know, he's not much older than me. I think he's about 55, that he's going to get around $400,000 for the rest of his life. Now, given that he's just had 5 or 6 years on over $1 million, plus he was probably on a higher salary even before then, maybe not as high, but, you know, certainly well paid. These are the last people that need defined benefit schemes. I get, you know, 50 years ago, you know, some people may have given up a career in the private sector, but I don't buy that whole, you know, you're worse off in the public sector anymore. I mean, you know, I've got some figures out. So there's some departments there that pay some very high salaries and do very, very little. So we really need to crack down on that. So effectively, yeah, it's a very simple option for the voters. It's like, either you want more bureaucrats in Canberra, or do you want more money in your pocket? And I'm pretty sure I know where most people, you know, what most people think in regards to that. Now, the second one, of course, is basically enabling people to choose the type of childcare, how they spend that childcare assistance. Now, at the moment, we have, the only way you get any childcare support is if you put your child in an institutionalised childcare centre. And what that has done is create an enormous amount of demand, and it's funneled through only one type of childcare. Now, there are millions of part-time workers out there in Australia, or shift workers. So shift workers is a good example, because they can't pick their child up at 6 o'clock at night. So if you're a nurse or a policeman, you work in hospitality, you know, you're a truck driver, you're a cleaner that has to work after hours to clean the office, you can't necessarily put your child in childcare. So you might prefer to actually, you know, have a nanny come to your house rather than go and, you know, put your child in childcare, because, you know, and you don't even have that choice. The other issue is part-time workers working 3 hours and 4 hours a day, paying for 12 hours of childcare. You've got people out in the regions, especially on farms, they can't, there's no point. Their nearest childcare centre might be 50 kilometres away or 60 kilometres away, if not further. The time it's spent to drop your child off, drive back to the farm and then pick them up in the afternoon, and even for outer metropolitan areas, it's similar. You know, you might spend an hour or 2 hours just dropping your child off in childcare. Yet again, they'd probably prefer a nanny on the farm. And then you've also got fly-in, fly-out workers who are sort of paying, you know, let's say they week on, week off. That week off's the equivalent of their weekend. Why are they paying childcare? Because often with childcare, you've got to pay for the full semester to get, you know, the child booked in. You're paying for childcare when you're not using it. And they wonder why, you know, there's not enough childcare places in Australia. Well, let's think about actually giving more flexibility so that you don't have to put your child in childcare. And, of course, you know, I won't lie here. I think it suits Labor. United Voice, I'm led to believe, is the fastest growing union in Australia. Almost all the childcare workers are unionised. Nothing wrong with that. But, you know, they're paying $16 a week, $14 a week, so $600 to $800 a year. You know, the unions are collecting $150 million in union fees out of this. So I'm just putting that one out there because, you know, the idea that these guys are doing this for altruism, and we'll touch on the next one, superannuation, in a minute. These guys have, you know, some of these so-called virtue signaling people, you know, they're really clipping the ticket on the way through, and they're not always as virtuous as they may seem. So anyway, that's to do with childcare. But effectively, it's money, it's empowering you to use your tax, you know, what the government is reimbursing a part of your taxes to raise your children. It's empowering the parents to decide what they want to raise their children and which sort of childcare they want. And I forgot to mention, of course, too, that, you know, there's actually parents out there that may be the difference between them going back to work and staying at home themselves, or giving the money to grandma and granddad as a way of keeping them in the workforce for longer. So, you know, there's that aspect. So the next policy is voluntary superannuation. And, of course, this is one of my, it's been one of my bugbears ever since 1992. I can well remember being at the water cooler in 1992. It was August. I don't know if you're old enough, or you are old enough, but you remember when they used to do budgets in August. And I can remember, spitting chips because I'd just finished my commerce degree, paid off hex, and then I was going to have 2% of what I thought then was a pretty low wage. Given to someone I'd never met after just doing a commerce degree. And I was thinking, well, why do I have to pay someone else to look after my money when I've just paid the government to finish my commerce degree? So I can't remember if I paid 1 or 2 years of HECS, but, I knew going forward that it makes no sense if you've just done a commerce degree. And, yeah, it's not just whether or not you've done a commerce degree, but from my point of view, it's like, why would I pay someone else to manage my money if I've just paid the government to learn how to manage my money myself? But, you know, if 1992, Paul Keating had gone to the public with a referendum in 1992 and said, by 2025, we're going to take 12% of your income, give it to someone you've never met, you may or may not get back when you're 67, do you want to do this? I doubt that many people would have voted for it. And a good example was across the ditch in New Zealand, where I think in 1997 there was a referendum on compulsory superannuation and they voted against it 92% to 8. So yet again, we now have over $3 trillion in superannuation. If you control $3 trillion amongst, say, 20 to 30 superannuation funds, you control industry. The majority of those super funds are controlled by the unions. The people that get on the boards, you know, they have a certain ideology and they're more interested in ideology than productivity. So, of course, today our industry is controlled and driven by ideology, not productivity. And I think, you know, we really need to turn that around. Furthermore, it's worth adding too that we've still got the same number of people on a full pension today, relatively speaking. So 50% of retirees are still on a full pension today. And I just did a post on social media about it from ASPA figures. Off the top of my head, the average median balance for women aged 60 to 64 in 2021 was $168,000. And for men, it was around $212,000, might have been a bit more. But both those figures were below the threshold to start getting going off a full pension onto a part pension for the asset test wise. So it's still not getting the bottom 50% of retirees off a full pension. Yet we spent, give up $50 billion in tax concessions and another $30 billion in an entire paper shuffling in superannuation industry in order to basically not reduce the cost of the pension at all, which is around $52, $53 billion. So it's really not achieving anything other than empowering those people who control that wealth to drive their own agendas. So yet again, we need to be able to enable people to access that money quicker to either pay off their HECS debt or pay off their home faster. And it's worth noting too, and this isn't all just because of superannuation, I should add, but the number of people retiring with a mortgage has jumped from 10% to 40%. And those figures are quite a few years old. So I suspect in the last few years, it's probably even higher. So yet again, we're creating a debt problem, with our house. And I think the best way to have a good retirement is to own your own house. But of course, the guys, the white collar workers in their ivory palaces are doing quite well out of it, but no one else. And then the last policy, I'd like to bring back a retail bank to fund a government insurance office. That would be a normal savings bank style model, similar to what we used to have with CBA. And also a infrastructure bank that if it issues infrastructure bonds, so the government can, the infrastructure bank can buy government bonds from the federal or state government secured against the seven sovereign assets, or what I refer to as the seven sovereign assets, which are dams, power stations, road, rail, ports, airports, and telecommunications. Because people do not understand monetary policy in this country. We have been brainwashed into thinking the only way to raise capital is by issuing debts to private banks. We can also issue shares. So there's two, if you're familiar with a balance sheet, on the left-hand side, you've got an asset. On the right-hand side, you have your capital account, which is either debt or equity. And of course, that represents debt or equity, mortgage or title. As a sovereign country, we have title over this land. And that means we're entitled to tap all that untapped wealth that is out there. So every time it rains, that's free water. Every time the sun shines, it's free energy. Soil, got there 4 billion years ago, whenever. So as the words of our national anthem says, it's just wealth for toil. So if you combine those three ingredients, you can build dams, you can plant crops, you can, burn the coal, whatever, uranium, generate power, and away you go. You can create wealth basically out of thin air. And that's how you justify, issuing credit or expanding the volume of credit, as the 1937 Banking Royal Commission referred to it. That's a very good way of expanding it, explaining it, describing it, I should say, not explaining it, describing it. Because if you're going to increase the left-hand side of your balance sheet, which is people, if we've gone from 20 million people to 27 million people, that's your asset. We need to expand the volume of credit as well. And to do that, we should be issuing more equity, not just relying on foreign debt.
It's very interesting. And if I sort of stand back and think about it, there are sort of three thematics that come out. One is trying to right size government, because my sense is that government's got its fingers in too many pies and is effectively making more and more decisions for, the average Joe in Australia. The second is that we've got to think differently about some important issues like superannuation and the banking system and how that works. So this is not just marginal changes, it's quite substantive changes. And the third is you've tried to put people back at the center of all of this. So effectively government in the service of the people rather than the other way around. Because at the moment, my sense is that we've got a top-down dictatorial government that is more and more and more trying to determine what we can and what we can't do, whether it's a central bank digital currency or whether it's migration or whatever it is. So it comes back to my mind to defining quite clearly what government is for.
That's exactly right, Martin. And it's interesting. The one thing I've really come to appreciate in my time as a senator is what happened in 1776 and the American Revolution, whereby they basically, overthrew the British. And the British monarchy, and said, it's for the people, by the people. And that came home to me. It's funny, I can remember 20 or 30 years ago when they started, there was discussion about making the RBA independent, for example. And, because you can't trust politicians, they were going to lower interest rates to zero and et cetera, et cetera. And it made sense, right? You can't trust politicians. Who trusts politicians? I don't trust politicians, right? I'm Now, I am one. And I can assure you, as being on the inside, let me tell you, that is a very valid skepticism to have. Don't trust politicians. But over the years, and I guess there's probably, it's always been like this to a bit, but I just feel like in the last few decades, and, you know, I'll say 1980, I was 10 years old then, so that was probably when I'm old enough to remember politics. But it just seems to me that there's been this gradual reversing of the power structure, whereby once upon a time, you know, 1776 turned it all upside down and said, no, it's for the people, by the people. We're not going to have the government tell us that we can't print our own currency, i.e. the Currency Act, which was a big part of the reason for the start of the American Revolutionary War, and no taxation without representation. The concept of no taxation without representation, I think, is very well understood. But the Currency Act, for example, isn't understood at all. And what people don't realise is that Currency Act of 1763, 1764 was basically repeated 200 years later with the petrodollar. So what happened in the Currency Act of 1763 was that the British said to the American colonies, you can't keep printing your continental script, you have to use British pounds. And, of course, if you have to use British pounds, it means you've got to borrow that currency and pay interest on their printing press. And a similar thing happened with the petrodollar when they went off the gold standard. Of course, the dollar started to become devalued very quickly. Inflation took off, so they needed a way to control it. And very cleverly, they realized when they delinked the paper to a physical, i.e., gold, inflation took off. So they needed to relink it to a commodity. And to be quite frank, I think the idea of linking it to oil was quite a smart idea, in the sense that, you know, the world's biggest paper market was linked to the world's biggest physical market, i.e. the oil market. The only problem was, of course, was that the oil market was, you know, centered in the Middle East, or the people who had most of the world's reserves were centered in the Middle East. So the bankers, of course, needed a way to tap that, you know, to clip the ticket on all that wealth being traded with oil. So that's where the petrodollar came in and said, well, you've got to buy the oil with the US dollars. So that basically that means you've got to borrow US dollars to pay for oil, which means you've got to pay interest on US dollars, which means it goes back to the Federal Reserve. So slightly off topic of the question for people, but we do have to come back to the people. And I think, not that I want to spend the rest, you know, spent the last 3 years talking about this stuff and I want to move back to more monetary and taxation. But what I do think COVID did do was, the scales fell off a lot of people's eyes, I think, when just with the government overreach there, and so many people were impacted in such a bad way, that trust in the government and in a very bad way, this is too, by the way, trust in our own health system has declined. And I think we're getting to a point where there's a real cynicism, more so than, you know, I think it's, I mean, we've always been skeptical of politicians and government, but even more so now, you know, it's at rock bottom, and it's right across all aspects of leadership, you know, even the corporate sector, it's the media. Yeah, people just don't believe what they're told anymore. It's almost as though maybe I'm being exaggerating here, certainly on the right centre side of politics. I think a lot of people now are very much like, well, if the government says it or the media says it, I'm not going to believe it. You're going to have to prove it to me. Whereas, say, it wasn't that long ago, most people would trust what they were told. Now it's like, no, you need to prove it to me before I'm going to believe it. And that's not a good thing. I mean, it's always good to have a certain amount of scepticism. We don't want to just blindly follow people. But we also want to be able to trust our authorities. And unfortunately, I think many people feel let down by their authorities, for various reasons over the last few decades.
Well, I think part of it is that many people would suggest that some of the decisions that have been taken, particularly by politicians, have benefited large corporates quite nicely. I'm thinking of the gas industry and how that has played out in Australia, and very high energy prices in Australia, a result five times what they probably should be. Or another example is the banking system, which seems to me to have a golden pass when it comes to what they do vis-a-vis the ability of politicians to influence that. Or even things like the role of the RBA and what the RBA is doing. So on many fronts, ordinary people would feel disconnected from a lot of the decisions that have been taken. Migration, I guess, could be arguably another one where we've got very, very high migration that probably no one ever voted for, and yet here we are. So I guess the critical question becomes, how do we sort of turn the journey back towards this idea of people centricity of the political process, and how do people get involved and engaged? My concern is that many people just feel disempowered.
Absolutely, you're right there, Martin. Well, look, the first thing, if we want to, I guess, turn things around as far as the government's concerned, is to actually reduce the number of people who work in the bureaucracy, and that's one of the issues I wanted to, you know, in one of my key policies, is to reduce the size of the bureaucracy, because quite frankly, the ministers, so in you know, federally speaking, I think there's 22 or 23 cabinet ministers. They've got 52 weeks in a year. Let's assume they go on holidays for four. They're in parliament for 19 weeks a year. They're then, you know, around various electorates. And as a minister, it's not just your electorate you've got to be in. You've got to be in, you know, you've got to go across the entire country. So they'd be on the road for 20 weeks a year. So I'm estimating that they'd probably spend 10 weeks a year, if that, with the bureaucrats and the head of the departments. Now, given that many of these people, most ministers aren't even subject matter experts who've had a career in that particular industry, very few of them actually have the experience, step one, and then the intelligence, step two, and then the confidence to ask questions and push against the narrative in the media if they've got an issue with the bureaucracy. So, I mean, I know a couple of ministers who've told me that, you know, their own departments would often leak against them to the media. And it would get out in the media before they even knew about it, or, you know, and so, you know, it's designed to damage the minister, for example. So we somehow have to and get less government but better government. And a part of that will be reducing the size of the bureaucracy. And a good example last week was that gold mine near Orange was blocked. Now, that particular company had spent a couple of $100 million getting environmental approvals from the New South Wales state government, only to then go to the federal government and get it kiboshed. And that's not really fair on the New South Wales people either, because, you know, their right to royalties from that mine and the payroll tax from those workers is now being foregone by the federal government. It's easy for the federal government because they have many more sources of revenue, such as income tax and company tax and other things that the state government doesn't have. So they rely heavily on royalties and payroll tax, and yet you've got the federal government chopping off their income stream. So not to mention the poor old shareholders of that particular company who've spent a couple of $100 million in good faith at one level of government, the environment department there, only to have another environment department at the federal level block it. So this is a classic example where not only are they not serving the people, they're actually stopping progress. So but we need better politicians. We need more courageous politicians. I think there was a period there in the late teens, you know, between 2014 and 2021, where the rise of social media intimidated a lot of politicians, including myself. I mean, I was beat up by the media when I was a Senate candidate about a month out from the election for a 4-day stretch. Yeah, there's nothing. I didn't say anything racist, homophobic, or sexist. I pretty much said what I've just told you tonight. So, you know, they couldn't really sort of get me thrown off the ticket or anything. But, you know, it shocked me at the time. And of course, it was all reported incorrectly as well. So that intimidates a lot of people from speaking up. A lot of my colleagues, you know, they don't want to lose credibility. And I've had this discussion a few times this week with other people about, you know, being in a minor party, you know, and like last week, I was called 20, you know, I was in the chamber when a Labor senator referred to myself and others as conspiracy theorists 22 times in one speech. I've had Anthony Albanese call me a cooker for my childcare policy, Jason Clare calling me a cooker, Chris Bowen calling me a cooker. I've written to all of them asking them for a debate. None of them want to do it. So we need less bureaucrats. We need to lift the level of debate in Canberra so that we go back to talking about facts and figures and policies and issues in a respectful manner so that we can have a debate. And I sometimes think this form of abuse and bullying is actually deliberate, designed to distract from the key issue. Because when people go, yeah, hang on, why can't I keep my superannuation? You know, it's my money. I've earned it as a wage earner. When did I give the government permission to take 12% of my gross income, which might be 100% of my savings, to someone else? So these discussions that need to be had. But on the other side, people need to get more involved. We live in an age now whereby in-house entertainment is destroying society. And by in-house entertainment, what I mean is you can get up in the morning. You got up in the morning 50 or 60 years ago, you might have had the radio and maybe a TV channel. I know when I grew up and I was born in 1970, our commercial TV channel didn't start until 12 o'clock in the middle of the day with the Mike Walsh show. So there was no cartoons in the morning, for example. Like, that was on school holidays. I can remember when you'd get cartoons on school holidays in the morning, and that was really exciting. Now you've got two channels on ABC totally devoted to children. And that's just the TV. Then you've got, your iPhone, you've got Netflix, you've got online gambling. You don't need to leave the house anymore, whereas 50 years ago, you'd get bored if you stayed at home. So you'd go out and actually look to get involved in things as a form of socialising, whereas today, you can socialise at home. You don't have to go anywhere. So that's made it very difficult, and political parties, like a lot of other voluntary organisations, the memberships are declining. And unfortunately, we've seen this, and I can speak from very first hand on this, and I've been both in the New South Wales Liberal Party and the Queensland LNP. These parties are being run by careerists because, unfortunately, even though they're a very small popular percentage of the membership, the grassroots members are out doing real jobs. They don't have time to play the political game. So they might turn up to a meeting once or twice a month, vote once a year at an AGM, and maybe turn up to an annual convention. A great expense, I might add, too, just to turn up to convention. If you live in the regions, a weekend of convention here in Brisbane will cost people from the regions a couple of thousand dollars. So it's no small commitment to be actively involved in politics. But it's not just politics. I mean, it's even in your own school, at the school system. I stayed at home a few years before becoming a senator and got involved with the school PNC there. And out of the, there were probably 1% of parents that would turn up to school PNC meetings. We might get 10 parents at a PNC meeting, so maybe 2 or 3% of the parents. So yet again, if you're worried about what's being taught in the classroom, you need your parents to go to a PNC meeting, PNF meeting, and push back against the principal and say, we're not happy with this. So we do need to get activated. I saw a good meme the other day, and it had it was a cartoon-like meme, but it had a knight in shining armour, and the damsel was being sort of attacked by a dragon. She was calling out to the knight in shining armour to come save her, and he said, "Don't worry, I'm on to it. I'm just doing a petition now on social media." And it was a good illustration of doing a petition on social media is not going to actually solve the problem. You've got, and I can tell you, there's an actual petitions committee in Canberra, publications committee that deals with petitions, but politicians just don't have time to read them. And that's generally not what drives the decision. But the best way to change that outcome is get involved in a political party and try and, either have a run yourself through a political party or try and run as an independent if you want. Or even if you don't want to run, get involved in the administration side of it so you can help good people get pre-selected and run for politics, and then make sure once they are pre-selected that they don't lose their pre-selection because they stood up for the party values.
Very important point, that, because I have a feeling, having lived in Australia for a good number of years, a lot of people say, well, the sun's shining, I'll go and sit on the beach at the weekend, right? The fact is that it's ordinary people getting involved and making their voice known. And, there are lots of different mechanisms for that, but it does take time, effort, and a lot of effort quite often to steer the conversation. On the other side, we know that there are many career politicians who had, joined the party very young and just went all the way up through and never had any real world experience. And one of my observations is, as I speak to some of the independent politicians around, a lot of those, like yourself, had earlier careers. So you actually come to politics with a worldview that is not just a political view about getting re-elected the next election, because that's what you have to do. What you're trying to do and others are trying to do is to change things for real people. And I think that different life experience is a real part of this important conversation.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's important to note politics isn't a spectator sport. You do have to turn up and get involved. But you're right about but at the same time, you've got to understand and this is where I clash with some of my colleagues, is that the party was always a means to an end for me, which was that, you know, it was there to serve the people. And now, you know, I believed in the values of the party, which I might add the party values, they're the values of the Australian people. And I thought those values are the best way to serve the people. But I accept that, you know, when you're in the team, you're not always going to get your way and you've got to give a little bit to get a little bit. And you've got to, you know, that is a part of you know, being in a large organisation as well, because obviously when it comes down to a vote, it's a 50% majority rule, right? So, you know, to think that you can divide 27 million people in this country in just two camps on views when they may have hundreds of different views, it's not a perfect science. And, you know, that's something people need to understand as well. Sometimes you just got to realise some things you can't necessarily be a purist in every sense of the word, or otherwise nothing will get done and we'll get bogged down in arguing rather than getting something done. And, you know, a good example of that in terms of policies, you know, that we had these purists back in the 80s that said our car manufacturing wasn't efficient, so we just shut it down and let it go offshore. And it should have been like, well, okay, it's 60% efficient. How do we lift it up to being 80% or 90% efficient? So these are the things sometimes you've got to work on improving things rather than just walking away from it altogether. And that's what the reason why I did try and stay in the Liberal Party was that I felt it was better to try and improve things from within the tent. And that would have been my first choice. But now that that door's been closed to me, I don't want to die wondering, and I don't want to just sit around for the next 10 months saying nothing. I want to, you know, get back to talking about these issues, these five key issues, and use that experience that I gained throughout my working career, particularly in tax and monetary policy and inefficiencies in administration, i.e. the bureaucracy, and hopefully use whatever profile I have to raise these issues.
Well, excellent. And just before we go, I just want to go back to one thing that you've been very involved in over the last 18 months, and that's the regional banking inquiry. And for me, that's a really good example of showing that what people in head office think and, you know, in Sydney and Melbourne think about what's going on is very different to what's actually going on across regional Australia. And to my mind, that's another angle that's really important here. You know, the voice of Australia is not just the voice of Canberra.
That's exactly right, Martin. And I was actually surprised at how much support we got both from the public and the media. And can I say, it wasn't just, you know, a regional issue. It was actually a metropolitan issue as well. People want access to banks because, you know, many people, there's various sections of society, older people who, you know, can't use the computers anymore as they get older. There's immigrants who struggle to use English. There's small business who need to rely on cash. There's volunteer groups who need to be able to go to the branch and get their ID, you know, the 100-point check ID. So there's lots and lots of groups out there that need banking services. And I still like to go to the bank if I get a new home loan or something like that. You know, I want that face-to-face service. And banking is an essential service. And I believe the best system for delivering essential services in this country or, any, you know, in any model of government is to have, by all means, a private sector that deals with the cutting edge and, you know, let the market rip side of things. But then you've got to have a public bank or a public institution that provides, you know, base services to make sure that all Australians have access to essential services. And it's similar to the model, I think, what we should have with our banking system being an essential service is the same as what we have in education and health, whereby we do have public schools and public hospitals, and they're complemented by private schools and private hospitals.
Yeah, and it's interesting, of course, if you had a public bank that could actually take deposits, that would probably be a very attractive place for people to park money because the risk would be lower, and that could also form effectively a funding base to be able to make investments in growing Australia. So there is an economic benefit more broadly as well.
That's exactly right. And, you know, if we look at what happened after we privatised CBA in 1992, I mean, the net result of that was, you know, 25 years later, we ended up with a Royal Commission into financial misconduct in the banking sector. And this is the other thing. It's not just, you know, transactional competition. You want ethical competition as well. And, you know, if you look at, say, the health sector, if the public sector gets too bad, then, you know, hopefully the private sector will maintain quality assurance so that people have, you know, unfortunately it'll be financially based, but, you know, that will hopefully lift the public sector up. Same for schools, And we want that in banking as well, but also in an ethical way, where the private banks were getting too unethical. You want to then go and take your business back to a public bank that you know, if something goes wrong, you can take it up with your politician that say that the banks aren't behaving correctly. And that privatisation of CBA happened at the same time they mandated superannuation. And that was just, and this is, and I'll criticise John Howard and Peter Costello for this. They should have shut superannuation down in 1996 when they got into power. And they didn't. They rolled over, and CBA bought Colonial Mutual, National Bank bought National Mutual, Westpac did it, I think bought Bankers Trust, and ANZ did a joint venture with ING. And I remember reading one year, CBA's wealth management group had a return on equity of 66%. Now, to be making that kind of return on equity, that was just outrageous. And of course, they don't bear the risk if those clients' funds go missing, because the client wears all the risk. But that's a classic example of how, you know, the white collar workers, you know, managers, you know, basically feeding off the fees from superannuation were just, you know, as I call it, the rivers of gold. I mean, I often criticise the unions loving superannuation because it provides rivers of gold, but it was also providing rivers of gold to the banks as well for a very long time. And that was a real strategic mistake by the Liberal Party, because not only did they not uphold their values in allowing people to choose how, you know, if you earn that money, you should be able to keep your 12%. It wasn't 12% back then, but I think it was 4 or 5% in the late 90s. But you know, it ended up resulting in a poor outcome. And this is one of the things we hear, oh, privatisation is going to increase competition. Well, it hasn't increased competition. It's consolidated the competition in the market. And we're basically down to now four major banks, Bendigo and BOQ, I think, which is pretty much on its last legs. Suncorp's just been taken over, the banking part of that. And there's a handful of other smaller regionals. But they're all struggling, those regionals. So, yeah, we're definitely going to have to step in, I think, because there's going to be more branches closing.
Absolutely, and this is worth reflecting on the 32 billion fees that are taken annually from people to manage the superannuation system. You know, and you think, hang on a moment, who's paying that and who's benefiting? But that's another part of the story. Senator, thank you so much for spending some time with us this evening and going through these very important issues. And I think it's really, really important to underscore to people who are watching this show that, that there is a different way of thinking that you're talking about here, which is really important for the benefit of Australia and Australians. And all power to your elbow as you push some of these ideas forward, despite the fact I'm sure you'll get quite a lot of flack for doing it.
Yeah, thanks, Martin. Well, look, I look forward to the flack. These are policies that I'm passionate about. I've given a lot of thought to over the last 30 years. And, you know, I've lined up a debate next week with a neoliberal who I'm more than happy to take on over the reckless neoliberal policy of the 1980s. And, you know, bring it on, because they've thrown it all at me before. And so, you know, every time they, you know, throw it at you, you learn a couple of more lines or a couple of things you didn't think of saying the first time. But, yeah, bring the debate on. I'm certainly going to look forward to it.
Well, terrific. And feel free to come back on DFA whenever you want, if you'd like to discuss further, because I think these are really, really important issues. And certainly, I think you'll find a lot of support and resonance out in the country. Thank you, Senator.
Thanks very much, Martin. Have a great night.
Cheers.